Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Schmidt-Niven, clinical psychologist and child and adolescent psychotherapist. Welcome to Talking Child Development, the podcast of the Association of Child and Family Development in Melbourne, Australia. The association is a not-for-profit organization that aims to disseminate information about all aspects of child and family development to other professionals and the wider community. In these podcasts, we go a little deeper into the whys and wherefores of child, adolescent, and family life. We want to get away from a focus that's purely behavioral and quick fix based to delve more deeply into issues and ask questions about why things happen in families the way they do. You can find more information on our website at www.acfd.com.au. You will also be able to access the references mentioned here on the website. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Bridie Huggins, who is a school psychologist with a master's in educational and developmental psychology. She has worked in a variety of public and private educational settings and across the age range from kindergarten to year 12. Her approach is to work closely with teachers and also with parents. She currently works in an independent co-educational school in Country Victoria. Welcome, Bridie. It's been a pleasure to hear about your work in schools over the time we've known each other. And today you'll be talking mainly about the increasing problem of school refusal amongst children and adolescents, which is also referred to as school phobia and more currently as school can't. This seems to be a problem that's exploded since the end of the COVID pandemic. I wonder if we can start by looking at the scope of the problem. I gather that school refusal is something in the region of children and adolescents missing about 10% of schooling in their academic year, and that works out at about 20 days in the year. Is that correct, or is that perhaps an underrepresentation?
Thank you, Ruth. Well, I do think it's quite tricky to define school refusal in a way because it presents quite differently. And I was thinking about this earlier in terms of there's a number of students that I've worked with that could be kind of categorized under school as a school refuser, but they may be presenting quite intensely for a short period of time. But then there's others who have more chronic presentation, which may go on for years, which I'm also working with. So I think that's one of the really tricky things about school refusal is it is quite difficult to define because it's so individual in its presentation.
That's very interesting. So in a way, one has to separate out the sort of anxiety about the great increase and the fact that maybe there's been a problem of school refusal that's been going on quietly for quite a long time. I mean, it's been an ongoing feature of the psychological problems of children and adolescents for years, really.
It has been, and I think I've noticed that. And like you said in the introduction, COVID has definitely impacted on that with school refusal. But it has been in a school presentation for all the years that I've been working in the schools.
Yes,
Yes.
and all the years I've been working as well, substantially, yes.
Yes.
And there's been a Senate inquiry into the problem of school in non-attendance. And do you have any idea what the findings have been and the recommendations of this inquiry?
Yes, well, I have looked into the Senate inquiry only because it is very interesting because they looked at a number of, well, they've involved a number of organizations within that Senate inquiry. So it was quite interesting to see. Some of the impacts or the findings that I found quite interesting was how significant the difficulty is on the family, so involving the whole family and the need for the family support. I think that was a huge area that got fleshed out a lot in the inquiry. And then also the need for us to really understand the different presentations of school refusal. In fact, they were saying about that there's no clear data on school refusal across in Australia, so we don't really have a sense about how it's presenting and how, kind of how we can best support these students. So really having a more consistent approach or even having some data around it would be quite helpful, because you do feel a little bit isolated. I think in a school sometimes there's, we know that everyone is dealing with school refusal in the school system, but you don't really know what other people, how other people are approaching it in a way, because it is very case by case, but also we don't have that data at hand as well. And we probably don't track it either that well, to be honest. And then another recommendation I found was quite interesting was having that flexible delivery of education, which is a recommendation out of the Senate inquiry. I remember talking a lot in the COVID pandemic about, oh, this education that we're now delivering online is really suiting some students, and they're actually thriving within this education that we're delivering with online. And how can we embed that into the school system now that we know this, that these students who are struggling at school are now doing really well? How can we create a more flexible system that could work for these students? And I know some schools have put that approach in. I know there's a private school in Melbourne who is delivering an online service, but I do think if we can embed it within the school system, it would be really helpful. It is tricky in a school system though, because it can be quite a rigid way of operating sometimes.
That's very, very interesting, because in my next question, I was going to ask you what impact the COVID pandemic has had on the problem. And in a way, you're saying that, awful as that was, it's also had some quite positive outcomes in terms of, I mean, for all of us on all sorts of different levels of how we can use technology differently,
Yes.
perhaps quite constructively. But I wonder whether COVID in itself has had a very a problematic impact on
Yes.
some children in
Yes.
school attendance, or whether it's affected their school attendance.
I absolutely think it has. For some students who perhaps may have experienced some kind of social anxiety before the pandemic, but then when we're not going to school every day and they're not kind of exposed to that anxiety every day and it lessens it, and then you're in lockdown for a long period of time and we're told to isolate from people and not be social and not go and see anyone, and then you're feeling safer and safer at home, we found that those students have found it particularly difficult to come back to school. And some students haven't been able to come back to school. It's just been too much for them. And I know they've gone to do schooling with like virtual schools or Victoria, which is kind of the old distance ed in a way, but they're thriving in that way of learning, but it has been too much. Their social anxiety has been too much for them to be able to come back to school, which has been tough.
Yes, I mean that's a problem, because they can't spend their lives indoors.
That's right.
This is going to be a problem as they finish their schooling and move
And
into.
then what? And we don't know, because we haven't got to that point yet for many of their students.
Yes. So do you find that you're able to help some children in the school setting who present with school refusal or school phobia, that you can help them get over it or manage it in some way?
Yeah, we do definitely have some success. I was actually just talking to a parent yesterday whose child really found this hard after all the lockdowns. And last year was probably the year that we saw that presentation more than this year, with the social anxiety they were experiencing. But for this young person in particular, we were able to help her sit with that discomfort, getting her into that kind of graded exposure type way of working into some classes, then building that to the next class. And she was really able to thrive. And now she completed year 12 incredibly successfully. And we didn't even see her. We haven't seen her this year. So for some students, yes, it really can work well about learning how to sit with that discomfort, which is a big part about it. And being able to expose themselves more and more to school has been effective.
Well, that's very positive to hear. I wonder also now whether you find that there's a kind of second wave of school refusal that's not specifically associated with the pandemic, but simply with a child or adolescent's reluctance or refusal to attend school.
Yes, and I think that does come back to the sitting with discomfort can be quite tricky for some students. And it's really one thing we have found is involving parents is so important in that sense, because this is, just from, I suppose, observations that those students sometimes will in and we have to think in the last in 2 years of the pandemic, we were really protective of our children. So we were protecting them from the whole world around us. So we didn't know how this was going to end. And parents go into that protective mode, and so they should. But I do think some to the detriment sometimes we have maybe a little bit overprotected our children and not allowed them to have that exposure to the difficult emotions or sitting with those challenging emotions and moving through them. And that almost has been a second wave with students, young people unable to perhaps sit with that uncomfortable feelings. And now they're back at school and parents are keeping them away a little bit more and saying, "Oh, you're not feeling so good today. Let's have a mental health day," or whatever it might be. So it's a bit of a push-pull sometimes.
Yes. See, I wonder whether that links with the next question, which is that these issues are really experienced in many other countries at the moment. And it leads on to a kind of group and community phenomenon where young people these days appropriate medicalized and psychiatric labels to themselves. And their behavior and their reluctance to attend school may sometimes be described in terms of a variety of different kinds of psychiatric disorders or symptoms. And at the same time, these disorders or labels become a substitute for the formation of an identity. And the problem is that these young people seem not to comprehend how powerful and potentially life-altering these labels really are, and how inappropriate. And I wonder whether you've observed that in the school setting.
Yes, in fact, this has been quite a topic in our peer supervision groups within the groups that I do attend, because it's not just our school that we're noticing this. It's across a number of schools that we really are being asked by young people. Young people are coming in to see us and saying, "I've got this, and this symptom." Basically, I've got ADHD, or I've got ASD, or I had one the other day saying I've got borderline personality disorder. Like, there's a lot of labels that are being thrown out there, and they seem to have this knowledge, but not knowledge about what, how that might present or what it actually is. And when you do a little bit more of a screener or work out what's below that and why they're so wanting to get this label, it does seem to come back to identity and wanting a sense of belonging. And as adolescents, as they should be doing, it's that sense of belonging. Where do I fit? Who am I? All those questions. But at the moment, we seem to be really noticing that part of that, or part of the identity that they're trying to shape, is really a lot about labels and psychiatric diagnoses. And it's a very interesting time at the moment that we're observing.
It is, and very worrying. Are you able, as a group, both in terms of the psychology counseling services and teachers, to really confront that? Because the danger of children. I mean, I think my position about ADHD. I feel it's not a fantastically evidence-based disorder, and also the idea of borderline personality disorder. The extreme seriousness of that. That it seems that young people are not aware, and indeed their parents may not be aware that these sorts of labels become attached to people through life and have enormous implications in terms of job opportunities and a variety of experiences. And of course, in the vast majority of cases, they have no connection with any of those problems. So are you able to sort of, in a more robust way, challenge that and say this is absolute nonsense, really?
Well, I do often think about you as well when I'm talking to young people, in terms of looking at the perhaps the meaning behind why they are asking for that label, or what is it? And then we'll explore that a little bit more. But I do have a lot of conversations with parents. Today I've spent, I think, about 3 hours all talking to different parents about similar things in a way. But I do, I have robust conversations with parents. But I mean, we are fortunate in the sense that we don't diagnose at school. So I am fortunate to be able to work with young people and how they're presenting to me, and work and build up whatever skill set they may need to help with whatever they're experiencing. But I don't diagnose. So if they really want to pursue that, they need to go to see someone else. And that does work in my favor a little bit too, because it's nice to just work with the young people around how they're presenting instead of seeing it as a diagnosis.
Yes. Oh, that sounds very helpful. I wonder whether, in a way, we, you know, the adult world have to take some responsibility for these problems, because there seem to be fewer opportunities for young people to be able to develop what I'd call a robust identity. And social media seems to play a large part in this, because it emphasizes the what I would call the fabrication of an identity, that you can just get an identity by virtue of calling yourself whatever it is. And this seems, it's very, very thin, of course, and problematic. And it seems to go together with a lack of opportunity or lack of understanding that we have to grow towards an identity. There's a journey we have to go
yes.
on. And I don't know, somewhere along the line, the adult world has not made that clear enough to people. And it hasn't given them opportunities for going on this journey. And I wonder what your thoughts are, because the educational setting is a very key one on this journey, isn't it?
It is a very key one. But I agree with social media, and that's where a lot of young people get the information on the psychiatric disorders as well, and see the different symptoms that are put up on social media. And then say, oh, well, I've got that and I've got this, so that must be who I am. And I still remember that when I was doing psychology, when I remember the abnormal psychology class that we went into, and the teacher saying, you will identify yourself with these symptoms, because we can all identify ourselves with certain symptoms when we look at a diagnosis. So it can be quite confusing, I think, for young people, because they don't have that context behind them. They're just seeing the symptoms and then relating to the symptoms. Social media, there's pros and cons, I think, and working with young people, I can see a lot of the pros as well as the cons. I think young people are much more aware than they were even 10 years ago about when to come off social media to give themselves a break, or what algorithm they can predict to help them and to not be flooded with unhelpful information. There is a lot more knowledge for young people. But then if you're having a difficult time with identifying who you are or exploring that yourself, then you're going to be attracted to different streams in TikTok or Instagram or whatever it is that will align those difficulties for you. So it's not hard to search for what you need in social media, and sometimes that can be very unhelpful. Yes, and I think the adult world really needs to help with that.
I think it does. I think the adult world, if I may say so, I think the educational system has stepped back from its responsibility in this regard. It hasn't been imaginative enough.
Yeah.
It's always playing catch up. And I feel really that if young people are so glued onto social media and feel they have to get an identity from that, we've let them down pretty badly. And I'm just picking up on something you said earlier, which is that at times it seems as though young people appear unable to withstand any distress when there's a mild problem or a hurdle to be overcome. And this may then make them think, oh, I've got serious depression, I've borderline, I've got ADD, ODD, whatever sort of for a short phrase they can think of. And again, I think there's not enough understanding in the community about the nature of development. But then, interestingly, at the same time, we observed during lockdown, I don't know if it was like that where you were living, but in our supermarkets, they were entirely manned by school children who were the shelf stackers. And they also advised people and had to handle some very difficult customers. But they did the most wonderful job. And I recall someone saying in the depths of the pandemic that you don't need someone with a PhD, but you need a shelf stacker. And these young people absolutely rose to the occasion and were fantastic. How do you reconcile that? What are your thoughts about, on the one hand, you get these terrific young people doing a great job, and then the next minute they're telling you they've got all these strange syndromes and they're fragile. What sense do you make of that?
I think young people are incredible, and they almost know too much in a way. Like, we are flooding them with a lot of adult world all the time because that is their world, unfortunately. But when they're given, but then we're also not allowing them to, we're still smothering them as well in a way. So I think it's a challenging time to be a young person at the moment. But when they are given that opportunity to do something with that responsibility, they can really thrive. And we were talking about this recently, that there's that sense that those roles and rituals and things that used to be a bit more part of society, even in scouts or things like that, where you have those responsibilities and then you are pushed to the next little bit, and then you're out of your comfort zone, but then you're able to thrive again, and you build so much about yourself and who you are, and you're pushed, and but then you're able to match up to your comfort zone. So that's it. I mean, being a shelf stacker in the supermarket during COVID is a great example of that. They're out of their comfort zone and then they thrive, and then they learn so much about themselves through that experience. We need more of that in a way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I suppose the next big question is, what role do you think that parents play and need to play in managing these problems without feeling that they're being blamed?
Yeah, that's a huge one, because thinking about a few students at the moment who are having a really tough time getting to school. And I think as parents, and we all do it as parents, we kind of look at ourselves and blame ourselves in a way when our children aren't coping that way. What have I done? How can I do better? I do find it's quite an automatic reaction for parents. So when we're working with students in particular who are finding it hard to get to school, really involving the parents and empowering the parents is one of the best things we can do. It's way more effective than working with a young person in a way.
I totally agree with that. And particularly also working with the young person and their parents. I think, we are both committed to supporting parents in a variety of different situations. And of course, there's excellent parenting going on, but we've also observed at times the potential for collusion between, say, the school refusing child or adolescent and their parent, in which the parent seems to be struggling to assert a boundary or what I would call appropriate authority. And one of the difficulties I think sometimes is that we don't want to go back to parents being authoritarian, but I wonder whether sometimes parents confuse being authoritarian with having authority. And also in stating what I would call hierarchy, someone's got to be in charge and it has to be parents. And that also can help with the helplessness that they may feel, or the sense that the young person, they have to service the problem that the young person has. They become a servant of the pathology in a way, which is not really a pathology. And how can parents be helped to get through that? And I just wonder what your experience is in that area.
And we've been talking about this as in our team a little bit too, because we've been running the Tuning Into Kids and Tuning Into Teens parenting program, which is a brilliant program, and noticing that parents who are coming through now, back in the day it was authoritarian, but now it's kind of gone to the other extreme of that more laissez-faire approach, where every emotion is okay, and we will be with you through this difficult emotional storm, but there's no boundaries. There's no helping that next step to put the boundaries around for the young person. So, and they often talk about this in the Tuning Into Kids program about the need for the emotion coaching, where it's, accepting and validating and empathizing with that emotion, but also putting the appropriate boundaries around the young person. And we are definitely noticing that within our school system at the moment with parents. There seems to be quite a trend with a bit more laissez-faire approach, which does have an impact on students and children and young people, and especially for that the child who is school refusing does definitely need some boundaries around them to help them come to school and be at school and knowing where the boundaries are as well.
Absolutely. I think they also, I know you talk about this particular parenting course, which I think is very helpful. And I've previously interviewed one of the key founders of that parenting course, Tuning Into Kids. But, tuning into kids also means sometimes tuning into ourselves. And I think there seem to be two emotions that people get very anxious about. One is anxiety, and the other is depression. Yes, and I think we need much more education about emotional states of mind. In other words,
It's a
there's a lot of
state.
anxious making issues in the world, but anxiety in itself is not a sign of pathology.
No, it's
You've got to have a
functional.
bit of anxiety to just get on with life.
That's right.
Also, people are very worried when there's some kind of depression or sadness, whereas in fact you need a bit of depression and rejection
Absolutely.
because it's you need to be able to reflect on things or have genuine feelings of sadness, which can also be mobilizing. So I'm not talking about extremes of anxiety or clinical depression of people not being able to get out of their beds. But I think people's awareness or understanding of the ordinary emotional life is very limited, and they run straight into, into psychopathology. And then the question is, well, how are we getting? Does that mean we must never have any emotion? Or they talk about, I just want my child to be happy. Well, that's a big ask. I'm not sure that's the aim of life, actually.
No, I don't think so either. Not at all. We wouldn't be. If we're happy all the time, we wouldn't be happy.
We
We
wouldn't be
need to
happy. We
experience
would
all the
be,
other
there'd be
emotions.
something weird about it.
Yeah, it would be. But we do get that a lot from parents as well, that my child is sad or anxious. We get that a lot. And then when you do sit with a child, you realize that this is just normal developmental states of mind that a young person is going through. And to help the young, we do talks as well to whole year levels about this kind of, because there is a lot of almost misinformation or scare tactics out there.
Absolutely.
And parents definitely feel that as well. So for a parent, because we do the parents because we know that if they are able to sit with their own emotions of discomfort, then they can help their children sit with the emotions of and discomfort that comes with it, but also to really normalize it, that we are human, we will experience these emotions and have those techniques around them as well.
Absolutely. And it would be bizarre if we didn't experience that.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of being human, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, I sometimes wonder whether, rather than thinking about achieving total happiness, whether it might be more reasonable to assume that one can help children or oneself into reasonable contentment.
That's a nice, lovely way of putting it.
But total happiness is, I
Never,
think, it's
never.
a little bit beyond reach.
Absolutely.
So, just one final question, Bridie, which is a very big question, which is, do you think that schools themselves need to change in terms of how they teach, what they teach, whether some of the sort of continuing ways of teaching, which have really been around for the last century, need to be a bit challenged? I mean, one of the things that I find I get a bit concerned about is that I feel that just that schools are very, I know this may sound an odd thing to say, but I think people within the school, apart from the students, are reluctant to learn. Learning has to, everyone has to learn in the school, including the teachers and the managers and the heads and everybody, not just the children. And I think there's a notion that it's only the children who have to learn. And then it's as though there's a great reluctance, I think, at times in education to shift. And it's as though it's business as usual. You do the same thing year in and year out. And then you add on something called a well-being group, you know, and depending on the wealth of the school, that can be a little sort of, horrible little room somewhere out of
Yes,
mind in
that
a
no one wants to access. Yes.
or a rather grandiose building.
Yes,
In actual
yes.
reality, it doesn't make very much. There's very little connection between the learning and the well-being, because you've also got to learn about well-being.
Yes,
And
yes.
so, what are your thoughts about that? I know that's a very challenging question.
Yes, but it's a very important question. And I do think there's a great opportunity in the education sector to bring in the well-being and to help young people and to be innovative. It is difficult. I think there's a lot. Definitely acknowledge that there's a lot that lands on teachers and educators, and there is which is why there is a huge burnout rate for educators. It is a very tough role. I do feel like, and it might be very school dependent as well, but I am noticing a shift where there is more learning coming in, and there is more acknowledgement that every teacher is also a teacher and a carer in a way of well-being and looking after students. We have like we're invited to do presentations to staff regularly as well, so to bring in that well-being hat to help teachers and empower teachers to help them understand what might be going on behind the behavior that they're seeing in a classroom setting from a student. So there is a bit of a shift, but there is also a long way to go because it's also, you think about how much BCE has changed on the years that we've had it, not much at all. It's very curriculum based and there's not a huge amount of wiggle room and there's a lot in the curriculum. So people are overwhelmed with that. But if there is, I know even New Zealand, who I don't think they, don't think they even have an ATAR, or a lot of schools don't have an A equivalent for an ATAR there, which says a lot about their school system, because there's a lot of pressure, I think, on the ATAR system in Australia as well, which has a lot of stress on students. And anyway, that's another huge
Absolutely,
topic.
yes.
Yes, but the thinking about what we want our young people, who we want our young people to be, and this difference between a ranking in year 12 compared to the reality of what we're looking for in young people in adults when they do graduate, cares about the ATAR in a way. We want all these other skills that they can build up to be the young functioning adults that we would like them to be. So there's a lot in the education world. There is hope, but there is also a lot that could change for it to be more productive in a way, or preventative and helpful.
Yes. And I think that sounds very, very hopeful. There's always one thing that I've been very struck by, which is how any school of any kind has an enormous resource available in the form of the parents of the children,
Yes.
by which I don't mean bringing them in to run the occasional FATE or a bit of
No,
fundraising
yeah.
or doing a bit of baking. I'm really talking about a different kind of partnership.
Yes.
People also talk about how parents can become intrusive and controlling and very unpleasant at times. But I wonder whether part of the problem is that parents are sort of traditionally kept behind the gate. The children are inside with the teachers. And I've often thought that if, when you ask a school principal, how many children are there in the school, and they'll say, oh, we've got, I don't know, 1,000 or whatever, you could multiply that. There'd be at least 3,500 or 5,000 people in the school community. So every school has a community attached to it. And I've often thought that it's the most underused community of all
Yes,
time.
I agree.
Which doesn't mean that you want the parents to come in and teach the children, but there should be ways in which we can be more imaginative about how we can use the true strengths of parents, and where you dissolve the not all the boundaries, but where you dissolve something about who's behind the fence.
Yes.
Perhaps that may also go some way to prevent parents from coming in angrily, with
Yeah.
outrage about how a child has been treated by their by a teacher, because it's something about bringing people in
Yeah.
and using their skills as opposed to keeping them outside. I mean, it may be too fanciful an idea, but I wonder what
Oh no, I
the final
absolutely
thought.
agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. Even just the example of doing tuning into kids with quite a we try to do it every year, so we are reaching quite a number of parents. And the parents that do that, it's not just about the program. It's a great program, but they connect with each other. Then they're more connected with the school. Then they're more available to hear the different responses that might be coming from the school and have that understanding about where the school is coming from, that they're more connected, so they come in and help more. And it creates a beautiful culture within a school when we involve the parents more and more. And the parents want to be involved. We have people waitlisted to do these programs, which is a big commitment. It's 6 weeks for 2 hours a week. That's a huge commitment, and parents are willing to do that. So that says a lot about parents and wanting to be involved, I think, and wanting to be part of this community. It's a really, I think there is a bit of an us and them mentality within a school and parents. But if we can break that down, it would be so beneficial for not just the students, but the whole school, the educators and the parents. It'd be amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, well, perhaps on this very hopeful note,
Yes.
we'll end. So thank you, Bridie, as always, with, some of your wonderful ideas. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruth. It's been lovely to talk. Thank you.
Hello, this is Dr. Ruth Schmidt-Nevin again. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. You may be interested to know about my audio trainings based on the many trainings I have run throughout Australia and overseas. These include training on relationships, attachment, and the brain, time-limited psychodynamic psychotherapy, and skill building in therapeutic work. You can access the details of all my trainings on my website, which is at www.centerforchildandfamily.com. That's AND, so www.centerforchildandfamily.com. Thank you.